Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. The COVID-19 virus is once again surging in every corner of Pennsylvania. There have been an average of about 6,900 positive cases reported over the past week. That's 2,000 more than just 2 weeks ago. Contrary to what happened in the spring is that more people, younger people, I should say, are testing positive. What's not different is older Pennsylvanians, especially those living in nursing homes or other long-term care facilities, are most vulnerable for getting sicker and dying. At least three COVID-19 vaccines are on the horizon. The Pennsylvania Department of Health released the state's plan, which is organized in three phases. The expectation is that in phase one, there will be a limited supply of the vaccine, so the state has prioritized who should receive it first. What will it mean for residents and workers in long-term care facilities? Joining us in this portion of today's program is Zach Schamberg. He's the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, which advocates for long-term care facilities. Mr. Schamberg, welcome to the program.
Scott, good morning. It's great to talk to you again.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Zach Schamberg, how would you describe this situation in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities in Pennsylvania today?
You know, it's a great question, Scott. And unfortunately, what I think is that we have come full circle from when you and I spoke at the beginning of this pandemic in late February, in early March, and into mid-April. We are seeing, as you mentioned, increase confirmed case counts of COVID-19 throughout Pennsylvania rise each and every day. And it feels like sometimes we're setting new records each and every day here in Pennsylvania for those new case counts. So why is that important for long-term care? Because all the independent research, whether it's from Harvard, Brown, or the University of Chicago, points to the same thing. And that's that greater community spread equals a greater likelihood of spread in our long-term care facilities, in our nursing homes, in our personal care homes, in our assisted living communities. So as we're seeing those cases in the community go up, unfortunately, that is having a direct impact on our nursing homes, on our personal care homes, on our assisted living communities, because we're seeing rises in staff cases. We're seeing rises in resident cases. We're seeing more hospitalizations. This is very, very concerning to long-term care providers. And I know we're going to talk about the vaccine, but that vaccine really can't get to long-term care soon enough.
One of the differences, though, between when we did speak at the beginning of this pandemic in the spring and in the summer is that the state started widespread testing in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. And I don't want to say paid more attention, but realized it was a priority to because that was some of the most vulnerable people. Has that changed at all as far as the number of cases, the percentage of cases during this surge?
Yeah, we're still seeing that challenge where long-term care has not been the priority of any kind of relief effort as it relates to state government. So the test that you're talking about, and we talked about this on your show months ago, this was a mandated baseline test for all nursing homes, for all personal care homes, and all assisted living communities for residents and staff. Now, that test was completed in May and in June. The challenge is that now the federal government is mandating that nursing homes test their staff once a month, once a week, or twice a week, depending on the county positivity rate. So that has continued. That cost is coming from the providers directly. That is unsustainable moving forward. So we're having a challenge with testing. We're seeing challenges with PPE once again. You know, at the beginning of this pandemic, We saw a shortage of N95 masks, then it was gowns, and today, Scott, unfortunately, it's gloves. So it's really a case of what will we need next in terms of PPE. The number one challenge that I hear about on a daily basis from our providers on the front lines is staffing. More staffing assistance is needed. Unfortunately, staff are either walking out of the building when COVID gets in or they're becoming sick. So there are real challenges with staffing. You know, at the start of this, I mentioned that we've really come full circle. And those same battles that we fought back in mid-March and April, whether it was for staffing, PPE, testing, funding, unfortunately, Scott, we're having to talk about that once again today on November 30th, that providers are still encountering challenges with procuring those supplies and those essential elements for mitigating the spread of COVID-19.
You know, Zach, often when we talk about these things, I say we, not just the two of us, but we as a society, when we talk about this, we kind of lump PPP together. That do you have enough PPP? Well, yeah, but you just mentioned something specific, is that right now you're seeing a shortage of gloves. I just have to wonder, how can that be this far into this pandemic?
Well, and that's the challenge, and that's the point of contention from a provider standpoint and then from an advocacy standpoint where I sit here in Harrisburg. And what we saw, unfortunately, was after that baseline test was conducted for all long-term care facilities, Pennsylvania experienced a bit of a lull in the summer months, if you recall. Cases went down. We were seeing maybe 400, 500, 600 new confirmed cases a day. And instead of looking back at where we went wrong at the beginning of the pandemic, when the first surge occurred, I think we rested on our laurels and we sat back, we relaxed, we took a deep breath, and we tried to get ready for what was next without learning from our experience, without learning from some of the mistakes, frankly, that were made at the beginning, in the beginning months of the pandemic. So, yeah, we are seeing those same challenges pop up once again. We're encountering those same barriers to success. And to your point, you know, you think, how could we have another shortage of PPE? How can we have another shortage of staff or another shortage of testing supplies? But unfortunately, that's where we are right now in Pennsylvania, especially, Scott, as cases continue to rise.
In your industry, turnover, staff turnover is a huge challenge. Part of the reason, and we've discussed this even before the pandemic, is that many people who work in your industry are not well paid. Something that hasn't been discussed very often, as far as I know, during the pandemic is staff turnover. I mean, we hear a lot about getting staff tested and staff bringing possibly some positive cases into the facilities. But what about turnover? Have there been a lot of people who, working in your facilities that have said, you know what, it's too dangerous, I don't get paid enough, I'm leaving, I'm looking for another job? Have you found that?
You just spelled out the number one concern of long-term care providers, not just in Pennsylvania, but I think throughout the entire country. And you said it, Scott, before the pandemic, last year in August, our Auditor General, Eugene DePasquale, released a report specifically about the long-term care workforce that was entitled, Who Will Care for Mom and Dad? We were experiencing a challenge with the workforce and a shortage, unlike this industry has ever seen, long before COVID-19 came to Pennsylvania. Now, what this pandemic has done, unfortunately, is exacerbated that issue. It's made it worse. And as we talk to providers today, you know, back in March and April, there was a real fear of COVID-19. But when we talk to providers today, you know what the three primary words we hear about when we talk about staff? Fatigue, burnout, exhaustion. And with all that's being asked of them, not just in terms of, you know, keeping our residents safe, but all that's been asked of them from both the federal and state government in terms of new regulations, in terms of reporting requirements, in terms of data input, I fear that we are going to experience a mass exodus from long-term care when all this is over. And Scott, we can't allow that to happen in the third oldest state in terms of our population in the entire country, and that's Pennsylvania.
Okay, so what has to happen? I know we're getting off on an issue that, you know, was even an issue pre-pandemic, but let's face it, Zach, long-term care is not cheap. Many facilities, most facilities, when fees are paid, they're fairly expensive for most people. So why aren't workers being paid better than they are?
Well, I think you have to look at the state's Medicaid program, unfortunately. And yes, you're right. The cost of nursing home care out of pocket is expensive. The challenge in Pennsylvania is that more than 70% of our nursing home residents rely on the state's Medicaid program to pay for their care. And unfortunately, the state's Medicaid program hasn't received an increase or a funding increase or investment in for the better part of the last decade, since 2014. So while healthcare costs, as you know, rise each and every year on average before the pandemic, about 2.5%, the Medicaid reimbursement rate has remained the same. It's remained completely stagnant. So that goes to everything a facility does. It goes to the operations. And most importantly, to your point, it goes to paying staff and investing in staff. You know, one of the things that many providers did at the beginning of the pandemic was to start to pay their staff hero's pay or hazard pay, whatever you want to call it, but an increase in their hourly rate to keep them in the building. But unfortunately, given the investment or lack thereof that's been made in long-term care and the Medicaid program, that's unsustainable. So, you know, we're talking about what we need is a long-term investment in long-term care from our lawmakers, from Governor Tom Wolf and his administration when it comes to the Medicaid program in Pennsylvania.
Here's an email from Cynthia in Palmyra. She says, I'm an 80-year-old resident of a retirement community. One of the most important people in my life is that young man that puts the groceries in the trunk, allowing me to get food without going inside the store. I want him and others like him to get the vaccines before I do. What do you think about that, Zach?
I think that's great. And, you know, one of the things that the federal and state governments both in working in tandem have done is to prioritize not just Cynthia and other long-term care residents, but those healthcare workers. And it's really the plan now is long-term care residents are one and healthcare workers are 1A, so that we're prioritizing the distribution of the vaccine to those who are most vulnerable, and then, Scott, those who are caring for our most vulnerable.
We're going to talk about some strategies for the vaccines in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, it's our annual show about books for gift giving. Our panel will discuss books that would make great gifts. That's coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk. Joining us today is Zach Schamberg, who is president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. They advocate for long-term care facilities. We're talking about the coronavirus, COVID-19 in long-term care facilities. We're going to be talking about strategies for vaccinating residents and workers in just a moment. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so Zach Schamberg, let's talk about vaccinations. Things are looking pretty good right now. At least three vaccines could be on the way, maybe even another within the next several months. As you mentioned earlier, the state does have a plan. In your mind, what should the strategy be when it comes to residents and workers in long-term care facilities and getting those vaccinations?
And here. So both the federal government and state government are going to be tasked with prioritizing our long-term care residents and staff. So from the federal standpoint, there's already been a program that's been created and enacted, the Pharmacy Partnership for Long-Term Care Program. this is really going to work in tandem with pharmacies, independent pharmacies like CVS, Walgreens, and others to ensure that long-term care residents receive the vaccination. So this will facilitate safe vaccination of the program on site. It will facilitate the cold chain management and the fulfillment of reporting requirements to, again, ensure that all residents in long-term care are vaccinated. From the state perspective, they're really tasked with making sure that healthcare workers and long-term care workers on the front lines are vaccinated. That's the first phase of their plan, that essential workers are given the vaccine. Then you move to phase two and you start to talk about some of the general population. But Scott, I do think it's important to note that, you know, as we're seeing the news come out each and every day, to your point, we've heard about Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, and some of the other vaccines. We're seeing great, great results. And we may anticipate that a mid-December approval could take place. CVS and other pharmacies have already said, you approve on Monday and we'll start distributing the vaccine and getting folks vaccinated on Wednesday. That's pretty incredible. And we're very hopeful that's going to take place.
I'm thinking, though, Zach, about the logistics of this. I mean, for example, the Pfizer vaccine, we know right now has to be stored at 94 degrees below zero. CVS, other pharmacies that you've been talking about, some of those independent pharmacies, have already started acquiring freezers to store the vaccine before it can be distributed. Are there logistical challenges to getting the vaccine to these long-term care facilities?
Yeah, of course, Scott. And you know, you mentioned the temperature that these vaccines need to be stored at. Obviously, that was a big concern, one of the primary concerns for long-term care providers as we were learning initially about this program, because most long-term care providers, if not all, they don't have the facilities to house these vaccines. So it's going to have to be done in tandem with the federal government, with state government, and with the pharmacies. You know, I think it's important. We've learned a lot throughout the last 9 months, and whether it's rapid testing, whether it's, you know, some of the resources that we've utilized from both state and federal government, I'm certain that there are going to be challenges when this program is rolled out, and there are going to be hardships that we have to endure. But we're hopeful that working with our partners in both Washington, D.C. and Harrisburg, that we're going to be able to make this work, and we're going to ensure that the vaccine gets to who it needs to go to.
You know, I don't want to cast a doubt on this, Zach, but how can you be positive about that when you can't even get all the PPE you need?
Yeah, it's certainly a valid question. And again, Scott, you know, in terms of the prioritization of residents, and I can certainly speak to that. We have had nursing homes already sign up for the vaccination program. We've had providers sign up to ensure that they're going to be able to get it first. And, you know, in learning and speaking with CMS, some of our federal partners, our national organization, I remain very, very hopeful that this is going to work and it's going to be rolled out effectively as soon as possible.
Let's take a phone call from Mary in Lancaster. Mary, you're on the air.
Thank you. I had to rethink a little bit about what we talked about, Scott, but in my experience, having worked in long-term care as a social worker for a number of years, I watched the trend as independent nursing homes shifted from not-for-profit to for-profit status. The community, the CCRCs, the continuous care retirement communities are all not-for-profit in Lancaster County, but all of those that are standalone or independent have now shifted to for-profit. I saw the same trend going in York and probably other counties as well. While I agree with the need for Medicaid increase, 10 years without an increase is ridiculous when 90% of people in nursing home care probably are living on Medicaid now or are being cared for on Medicaid. To go that long without an increase is crazy. But what does the for-profit status do to the cost of care as well?
Thank you for your call, Mary. Zach, your organization, Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, you represent who?
We represent primarily for-profit facilities, but some of our members are not-for-profit. We have some of the largest not-for-profit long-term care providers in the entire state in our membership.
So what Mary, the concern that Mary brought up about nonprofit and the impact that it has, what impact has it had?
Yeah, it's a good question. And first, I want to thank Mary for her service in long-term care. You know, I think it's important here, especially as we talk about the pandemic, whether you're for-profit, whether you're not-for-profit, whether you're a one-star facility, whether you're a five-star facility, COVID-19 has impacted everyone throughout the state, providers, workers, residents. And you know, we haven't seen a correlation between, you know, whether a provider is for-profit or not-for-profit and how COVID-19 has impacted them. You know, I do think it's also important to note that for-profit facilities or for-profit providers care for primarily those who are on Medicaid. The vast majority of our Medicaid residents are in for-profit facilities across the state. So, you know, when we talk about an investment in the Medicaid program, when we talk about an investment in our seniors who are on Medicaid, that has a direct correlation to those for-profit providers throughout the state.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another phone call from Mike in Harrisburg. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I called in. Look, I've got virtually everything that you can have that makes getting COVID bad. So here's the deal. This looks like a scam to me a little bit, okay? We're going to now have 3 or 4 more weeks of evaluation, and like they've got the bravery to sit there and say, no, it's no good, we ain't going to do it. They're going to do it. So why don't they just ask for volunteers and say, who'll volunteer to take it today? Because I'm one of them right now. I don't need any more testing. Let's just do it. And maybe that'll tell people, hey, this really is safe, and I should do it too.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. And Zach, I don't know whether you could address what the FDA is going to do, but I think the point that he makes is that this is an emergency situation, and it's needed right now. And even though we will say this, just to point out that vaccines on the horizon, these vaccines have been developed in 8 months, where it normally takes an average of 4 years to develop any kind of vaccine. So I guess if you could address the point that Mike brings up, Zach, is it sounds as if everyone is just impatient. Let's go. Let's get this moving.
And I understand that. And again, as an advocate for long-term care, where obviously we're seeing our population be affected more than any other segment of the population throughout not just the country, but throughout the entire world. You know, we can't get that vaccine quickly enough. Again, the federal government and state government have prioritized long-term care residents. They prioritized hospitals, healthcare workers first. We're probably not going to see the general population get this vaccine until maybe the spring months. And that's a guess based on some of the information that we have now, but maybe February, maybe March, or maybe April. I understand the impatience, and I understand how quickly we want to get this vaccine out to folks. Now, I also think it's important, Scott, to note that, yeah, you're right. The general timeline or the ordinary timeline for a vaccine like this has taken 4 years, but I think the federal government did yeoman's work to cut out the bureaucratic red tape in Operation Warp Speed and get this done. And I think it shows us moving forward that maybe we don't need 4 years necessarily to work on and test a vaccine. But again, we're going to see it roll out hopefully in the next 2 weeks here. And then if all goes well, which again, hopefully it will, we'll get this to the general population as soon as possible.
All right, so Zach, I got to bring something else up, and that is that sure. Because this is a new vaccine, you know, so far it has been tested, it has been widely effective in testing. What about side effects? Are you at all concerned about residents and workers, but residents in particular, who could be most vulnerable, that because this is a new vaccine, that there could be side effects that we just don't know about yet.
Of course. And, you know, we've shared those concerns with state government. We've shared those concerns with the federal government about possible side effects, especially if staff members are all vaccinated around the same time. You know, obviously, our residents require 24/7 care, so we have to make sure that our facilities are properly staffed at all times. So if side effects or symptoms appear, will staff have to isolate? Will staff have to get tested? It's certainly a concern based on some of the results that we've seen in the first two trials. Obviously, things look really hopeful, and this vaccine will work moving forward. But Scott, again, it's certainly a concern of ours and for providers, not just throughout the state, but throughout the country.
Most polls that I have seen, and there have been just a few, have said that only about 60% of Americans would get vaccinated for COVID-19 right off the bat. That there is, you know, 40% that say, you know, I want to wait and see what happens. Will residents of long-term care facilities have the option of saying, no, I don't want it? Or maybe their family say, no, we don't want it until we make sure it works.
Yeah, and it's certainly a valid concern, and it's one that, you know, we've already talked to some of our members and some of our providers about, because it certainly will come up. And it's important to note that it's the right of our residents, and it's a right of their representatives to make those healthcare decisions, to refuse to take the vaccine. However, I would say that given that our residents are obviously most at risk for the virus, and because prolonged isolation that we've seen over the last 9 months is bad for their health, it's bad for well-being, I'm going to remain very optimistic that most residents, as well as most of our staff, will choose to take the vaccine when it becomes available.
Okay, so you say choose. There will not be facilities that will say residents must be vaccinated or they're going to have to find somewhere else to live.
No, I don't believe so. And because this was an emergency approved vaccine by the FDA, I don't think providers could legally mandate it for either residents or for staff. But we're still learning about that. As of right now, it certainly looks to be that way, that it can't necessarily be mandated.
Mm. On a side note, as we're wrapping up here, Zach, what about flu shots this year? Have most residents gotten flu shots, or are there plans to vaccinate those for the flu?
Yep, and that's always done year after year, especially in long-term care, again, where we have a vulnerable population. Yes, flu shots are being given. That process is being conducted. Obviously, it's a little different this year because of restricted visitation in long-term care. But yes, flu shots are certainly still happening, especially given the compounding effects with the flu and COVID-19.
You know, Zach, I asked you very early on about the conditions in long-term care facilities. I'm just kind of picturing this. Are residents separated when it comes to meals, when it comes to social activities? How are you keeping them socially distanced, especially when, you know, there are those that maybe suffer from dementia, may not quite understand what's going on?
Yeah. And, you know, Scott, one of the things that we've spoken about in the past on your show is that, you know, this issue has a direct impact on my family and I. My grandfather has dementia, and my grandfather is in a personal care home outside of Philadelphia. So, you know, we see this, and we've seen this develop over the last few months. These things are being conducted, activities, meals are being conducted in very small, socially distanced groups, especially over the summer months, again, when we saw sort of the lull in newly confirmed cases, that we started to reopen back to visitation, especially outdoors. We started to reopen in terms of the activities that could be done and in terms of the meals that could be served in a group setting. The only challenge is that, you know, again, as we're seeing increased cases throughout the state, and that has a direct correlation to the increased cases in our long-term care facilities, that, again, we're seeing visitation having to be restricted. We're seeing those meals and those activities, again, having to be restricted. And we know the impact that isolation, especially prolonged isolation, has on our population. So my hope is that the vaccine will be distributed, folks will take it, folks will be safe and remain safe in long-term care, and will very slowly this spring be able to open back up to those activities, those meals and visitation, because it is very, very essential for the well-being of our residents.
Zach Schamberg is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Zach, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Pennsylvania has certified the general election results officially, securing the state's 20 electoral votes for President-elect Joe Biden. This election was certainly one for the record books, given the uncertainties of the global pandemic and the nationwide use of mail-in ballots. Pennsylvania, especially for the very first time that it has been widespread. Pennsylvania counties can now take a moment to consider how lessons from this election can improve future elections. Joining us are Lisa Schaefer, who is the Executive Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, and Forrest Lehman, Director of Elections and Registration in Lycoming County. Welcome to both of you today.
Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Lisa Schaefer, how would you describe how this election and voting process went this year?
You know, our counties really faced a perfect storm of challenges coming into this election. You know, we had several counties that were still implementing their new voting machines back in the June primary. We were using mail-in ballots for the first time, which, although they're a carbon copy of absentees, were now available to a lot more of the public than had previously been available. So we were dealing with larger numbers. And on top of that, you add a pandemic that we were trying to keep voters safe when they're coming to vote in person. But that also made those mail-in ballots even more popular than we had anticipated. And you just add all those things up, and it seemed like things were going to have their challenges. But I have to give our hats off to all 67 of our counties for how smoothly everything went in the face of those challenges. We had very few issues, and those were just routine in nature. And I think that the public can be very confident and feel very good about how smooth the election went and feel confident about the results that came from it.
So you would call it a success. Were there any problems? You said maybe just what you normally see, but any problems, mechanical or otherwise?
No, we really didn't see any problems. And like I said, given the multitude of challenges that were thrown at us, I think our counties did a absolutely wonderful job of making sure that everything went smoothly this November.
Any evidence of fraud?
None that we have seen at this point. Everything that has been challenged in the courts has been dealt with. We've not been hearing of reports ourselves. So again, we believe that we can be confident in the results.
Forrest Lehman, you are the Director of Elections and Registration in Lycoming County, but I know you're very plugged in to what's happening around the state. I'll ask some of the same questions that I just asked of Ms. Schaefer. Your observations on how well, or maybe not so well, that this election went.
Well, counties worked very hard to make the election go as smoothly as it did. It required, I would characterize it as a superhuman effort by all 67 counties. We were having to bring in a lot of extra staff. We were working a lot of extra hours. And so in a sense, although the election went as smoothly as it did, it's not something I would like to go through for every election. You know, I think the experience that the counties had down on the ground told us all that there are some structural problems with the way elections are run in Pennsylvania that very badly need to be addressed. Some of them are issues we've been bringing to the legislature's attention for a long time. Some of them are problems that came up as a result of Act 77 and Act 12. But we don't want to have to turn ourselves inside out twice a year just to make the elections run as well as they did. Counties believe there's got to be a better way. And some of that is through badly needed changes to the election code.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. So what are some of those structural issues that you're talking about?
Well, I think the most important one is which the public saw after the November election, is the additional time that counties need for pre-canvassing, which is the process of opening envelopes for absentee and mail-in ballots, getting them unfolded, scanned in before the close of polls. We can't start that right now until 7 a.m. on election day. Counties were on the record asking for this starting back in April during the discussions about postponing the primary. We warned the governor and the legislature that results would be delayed if there was no pre-canvassing. And they failed the counties and their voters, and frankly, the entire country, by failing to do it. If counties had had even 3 days of pre-canvassing, Pennsylvania's outcome would have been known on Wednesday instead of Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Lisa Schaefer, I don't know if this is an exaggeration or not, and so I hate to describe it this way, but counties, the way Mr. Lehman just described it, you all but begged the legislature to allow pre-canvassing ahead of time. This has turned into a major, and not just pre-canvassing, but the structural changes that he just described, that has become a political football. How do you overcome that politics now to get these changes made?
Well, it's definitely going to be an interesting experience. As we've said, you know, we've definitely seen more partisanship than partnership over the last several months. But one is to firmly believe that we have a seat at the table, as counties do, to implement those changes going forward. We have a policy committee here within our organization that looks specifically at elections, and we're going to be doing our due diligence to look at the county experience and to make recommendations, both with pre-canvassing and in other areas as well. And we're going to continue to keep going back to the General Assembly and to the administration and having those conversations about where things can be improved, and to help, point out where there may be policy changes that are wanting to be made, that counties can help to help them understand, where are the administrative challenges, where can we be making sure that the language assures that we're implementing what their intent is. So really, it's just, it might sound like I'm saying, you said, and I think rightly, that we begged for months that we're going to keep going back and going back and going back and trying to, keep telling our story, both from our association perspective as well as at the county level. I mean, counties really have the ability to show what happened and to show their processes and procedures and help to understand what those impacts were. So, we certainly look forward to being a partner with the General Assembly and with the administration. We've also called for the Election Law Advisory Board under Act 12 to convene its first meeting. That was put in place as a stakeholder group that consists of legislators, it consists of the administration, counties, other stakeholders, really a good solid group to come together and try to make those meaningful changes that need to happen and be able to vet those ideas. So there's a lot of ways we can move forward, but what we can't do is continue to point fingers in the past, but look forward to how we can make things better going forward.
Well, at least I hate to say it, but that sounds great. And in a perfect world, it that's maybe how it should work. But the political reality is that everyone has taken sides and has pointed fingers. Let me ask about this Election Law Advisory Board. As you said, meeting for the first time. This was something that was created earlier this year before this election, but they haven't met yet. Why not?
Well, in part, after the board was created under Act 12, the members of that board had to be confirmed by the Senate. So till those members got selected and confirmed by the Senate, it was into the fall for that to happen. So, but again, in the lead up to the changes that we are trying to make, the board hasn't been convened. And we certainly think that, you know, if there's ever an opportune time for that board to be of value, and it's a board that we've actually called for the creation of for several years prior to its enactment, if there was ever a time for that board to come together and be effective, now is it.
We have a comment. Let's see, Amy in Hummelstown says, I'm absolutely against pre-canvassing. That will lead to fraud. People will leak the information inevitably. Your thoughts on that? And both of you can weigh in on this.
Yeah, I had the internet kick my soapbox out from under me. But I can certainly comment on that because I'm not aware of a single instance either in the primary or the November election where any information was about election results was leaked out of a pre-canvassing room. You know, counties did it in the primary successfully. We did it on election day successfully. The only way to get results out early would be for someone in my position to take an affirmative action inside a certified voting system to run a report. And everything you do in there is audited. And myself and certainly none of the election directors in the rest of the state, we have not met any candidate worth going to jail for. We're not going to run that report. And so anything that happens during pre-canvassing, we've proven it can stay private, confidential, and it would continue to do so, whether we had 3 days or 5 days or 7 days to pre-canvass those ballots before the election.
In your mind, what would be ideal for pre-canvassing? How long?
Well, I want to take a data-driven approach to it because I think what we saw when you had the governor and the legislature talking about it, this is the governor coming in and saying, well, I want 21 days, which, you know, seems a little arbitrary. And the legislature saying, we don't want to give anything, which I also think is unreasonable. But I think what we saw in the presidential election is that if we had had even the 3 days that were proposed in Act 12 initially or in HB 2626, we would have had a lot more results and to the point where Pennsylvania would have been able to be called. You know, so if we had 3 days or 5 days or maybe up to 7 days, that would seem a very reasonable range in which we could negotiate additional time for counties to pre-canvass.
You know, in the year 2000, the Bush versus Gore, I'm calling it a case because it became a court case then, that was decided by the Supreme Court. Florida was the state that had the most problems. In those 20 years, from what I understand, Florida has become almost a model of how this should be done. Now, it isn't often that you will hear other states modeling after what Florida does, but should Pennsylvania be doing what Florida does, that includes pre-canvassing? There were results known election night from Florida.
That's one of the things that pre-canvassing would accomplish. You know, Pennsylvania and a couple other states, everybody was waiting on us. And as a county election official, I mean, I have no personal problem with the rules as written. If we're told don't pre-canvass until election day and the whole country has to wait for 3 days. I mean, we did our work. We did it correctly. We did it carefully because we're more concerned with accuracy than with speed. But obviously the public and the media and a lot of elected officials had a problem with that. You know, there were even state legislators going out on Twitter saying they were displeased and disappointed with the pace at which the counties were counting ballots. Well, too bad. We have to do it correctly. And so if there is that much unhappiness about how that post-election timeline printed out, then we need to look at giving counties more time on the front end, exactly as other states like Florida had, and they were able to report relatively definitive results on election night. That's what Pennsylvania would need as well if we want things to look different.
As I told you, I'm jumping around a little bit here, but doubts have been sowed by President Trump and his lawyers about Dominion voting machines, that somehow votes meant for the president went to Joe Biden. That's even though I understand President Trump won 12 of the 14 counties in Pennsylvania that used Dominion machines. Do either of you know of any issues, any problems with Dominion voting machines in Pennsylvania?
No.
I've not heard of any, no.
So
I would stress on that topic, all of the voting equipment that's to be used in Pennsylvania has to go through a certification process at the federal and the state level. I mean, I don't have personal experience with Dominion voting equipment, but I do have plenty of faith in the EAC and also in the Pennsylvania Department of State that they did their due diligence in testing that equipment at both levels. And the certification reports talk about the testing methodology, exactly the paces they put that equipment through. And so, you know, a county that uses the Dominion equipment in and out would obviously know a lot more about the details of how it works. But I know that the testing regimen that voting equipment is put through in Pennsylvania does work.
But that
and to the same point, those counties that have those Dominion machines, like every county, you know, when they are preparing for an election, they're putting their machines through logic and accuracy testing as they're programming the ballot. They're doing their 2% check at the back end. So there are a number of checks in place to make sure that the machines are working properly as they are supposed to, regardless of whether they're Dominion or some other manufacturer.
Plus, there is a paper trail.
Keep in mind,
too,
all of this equipment is also a voter verifiable paper trail. You know, right. Pennsylvania replaced all of its old DRE equipment over the last 12 to 18 months. And so if there was ever a question about the equipment, the possibility is there to rescan all of those ballots on different equipment or to hand count them, because you have now the original paper ballots that are the official record of the election. And in fact, that's what was done down in Georgia, where they used Dominion equipment statewide. And the largest number of votes that changed were due to a single memory stick that wasn't uploaded. When you take that out of it, the eventual results changed very, very little. And I have every reason to suspect if the same thing was done in Pennsylvania, the results would also change very, very little.
We only have a minute or so left, but I do want to bring up, Paul asked this question. There's been a lot of talk about curing ballots. Accusation is that it happened to Democratic but not Republican counties. Curing meaning that there were some election offices that contacted voters who sent in mail-in ballots to correct something that they had done wrong. I'm not going to have you address that particular issue in the short amount of time we have left, but is it an example of how we need consistency in all 67 counties?
It absolutely is, and it's also an example, as I said earlier, of how we're going to be looking at the, and as Forrest said as well, those areas where we can be, you know, how can we make sure that we're addressing those situations? Where are there changes in the election code that we can improve the process going forward and make sure that we are running smoothly and consistently in the elections to come? Where can we learn from this going forward?
What's the next step? And I only have to ask you to do this in like 30 seconds. What's the next step? You've called for this to be part of the conversation at the table. What needs to happen?
What needs to happen? We'll be doing our due diligence to review what happened and learn from counties and make our recommendations. And then what needs to happen is a real honest conversation with the administration, with the legislature on what needs to be fixed, and a real honest effort to make those changes when the new session convenes in January.
Lisa Schaefer is the Executive Director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania. Forrest Lehman, Director of Elections and Registration, Lycoming County. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Always a pleasure.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.